Hi, welcome to our podcast. In this week's episode, our guest is Professor William Hasselberger, philosopher and professor of politics at the Catholic University of Portugal and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia. Professor Hasselberger will be talking with us about artificial intelligence, the winners and losers of technological competition, data protection, and state surveillance. Thank you for being with us. It's interesting the way the virus has evolved because it has allowed us to show how dependent we are on many things, ranging from communication to surveillance technology. So AI will change our relationships quite significantly, the way we interact, and it sort of feels interesting the way that things have evolved. For instance, when a few years ago there was this film with Tom Cruise about a policeman who could predict murders before they would happen, and it looks like in China they're developing technology to show how people may behave in the future. So how do you think artificial intelligence will affect our relationships?
When you ask people, sort of non-academics, about artificial intelligence and whether they think it's something concerning, people tend to respond that it is a source of concern. But usually the kind of worry that many people have is one informed by cinema, by movies, and often ones that are less subtle than the Tom Cruise movie that you mentioned, more sort of ideas about killer robots or computers that take over the world and start bossing us around. And those are not concerns to be completely dismissed, but those are concerns for the next 50 to 100 years or something like that. That's far beyond the capacities of artificial intelligence as we know it and use it nowadays. What most people don't know is that we are already enmeshed in a global system of artificial intelligence technologies that are involved in our daily lives quite comprehensively, from Uber ride hailing apps and Waze and biomedical screenings and even insurance assessments and polling and marketing, investing, finance, all these different areas are increasingly turning to advanced forms of artificial intelligence, machine learning, to transform the way that they do business, to become more efficient, to become more precise, to be able to make predictions about consumer behavior or political behavior or voting behavior in ways that was just not really imaginable even 20 or 30 years ago. So the real, I think, risks of posed to us in the short to medium term from AI are already emerging. There are things that already exist and are already sort of quite, they're not science fiction. They're things that are involve technology that already exists and the application of technology, predictive analytics and so forth that already exist. People's sort of conception of the risks of people's understanding of how dependent they are on AI and how they are carrying computers in their pockets that are far more powerful than the computers that were used to launch rockets by NASA in the middle of the 20th century, and that these computers in their pockets are, that is their smartphones, are constantly collecting data about them, about the number of steps they take. If you use, for instance, the health app in your phone, that's constantly collecting data about your movements and your calories and that sort of thing. The technology there, it already exists, and it's a matter of how we use it or how we regulate it that is the fundamental moral question. It's not a long-term, distant science fiction question.
So you feel, and it's true that we already have so much information. We give away so much information for free, in a sense, without hardly being aware of it. But also because it helps us in our daily lives, and for some things we're so much more productive. And I think that because of this crisis, this health crisis, and you start hearing about how this type of technology can help keep tracing people and understanding where spots of contagion are picking up and things like that. So many people may feel actually that they're contributing to the common good by doing this, because they're hopefully that will be good for everyone's health. But ultimately that can become a risk if it is misused. So I guess there are two questions. Is first, should we really do it? Can we actually avoid doing it? Can we avoid using all that technology? Is it fair to ask, if we have all this technology available, can we just say, oh no, but we're not using it because ethically it's not possible? Or do you feel that actually regulation is crucial? And in that case, at this stage, the place where it seems to be more advanced is Europe. But is it enough, or do you feel we need to go? Because that also creates, if only Europe protects data and no one else does, then of course European firms are at a disadvantage with others. So lots of questions about this, and I'm sure you have excellent answers.
Well, I don't know about excellent, but I'll give it my best shot. This is complicated territory, and there you point to a number of thorny issues in your question. The first thing that I think it's helpful for everyone to keep in mind is that all choices about new forms of technology involve what economists call opportunity costs. So when we choose to use a new system, or new, you know, computerized system, or autonomous transportation, or something like that, there are benefits from this, but there are, of course, the costs. There are the trade-offs, the values of the things that we're giving up by using that system. So contact tracing, as you referred to, you know, is a technology that uses, for instance, Bluetooth signals from different people's cell phones. They download an app, and then the proximity of different cell phones to one another using their Bluetooth connections can be employed retrospectively if someone is then later diagnosed with COVID. So they can then contact the people with whom they've come close, even if they're people that they don't really know. If it's just people, say, in a public space, or in an area that they, where the cell phone address has come close to other cell phones, they can then contact those people and let them know that they've been in proximity with someone who's infected. So the benefits there are, there are benefits there. There's some academic debate about just how beneficial it truly is. Australia has tried to use a contact tracing system that seems not to have worked very well. It seems only to have caught a few cases, or to have assisted in catching a few infections. But either way, there is a trade-off. There is a value, one good or value, which is safety, right? Physical safety, health on one side. But it is important always to ask, even if we end up choosing to use contact tracing, in order to make a wise choice, an informed choice, we have to be aware of what is the thing that we're giving up. What is the good or the value or the valuable thing that we're exchanging for that? What's the trade-off? And in the case of contact tracing, it's rather clear. It's our anonymity, our privacy, the fact that we are not being as of yet, in liberal democratic societies, unlike in authoritarian states, we are not being constantly surveilled in terms of our physical geospatial location, where we are. You know, that data is not being hoovered up by the government and stored somewhere. And there is a benefit to living in a society where, you know, the central state does not collect data about the physical location of every one of its citizens and whom they've come in contact with. Now, it may be that for certain short periods of time, it is, the basic idea is that there can be emergency circumstances in which the good of public health and public orders, something like that, is so overwhelming that we suspend temporarily our commitment to liberal freedoms and privacy. And however, we have to be very aware of the choice that we're making and take special precautions to ensure that such decisions are temporary. And normally when states gain access to data and information and gain power in new domains, technological power, it's hard for them to then give it up, just sort of historically speaking. If a state can gain a whole bunch of information about its citizens and use the technology effectively, ostensibly for the public good, it's just sort of going against the grain to expect that it will be easy to then rein that in at the end of a pandemic. So we have to be aware of the trade-off, and the trade-offs involved in applying technologies like that. And we should be vigilant in liberal democratic societies that the data is used in ways that are genuinely in the public good, and that can, and that the states don't permanently gain access to sensitive information about everywhere we go and whoever we meet with. So that just touches on one aspect of your question, but it's certainly opened up. This crisis has revealed both the promise of these new technologies, but also their danger, especially in democratic states.
Yes, that's very interesting, because it's very interesting because what you say is that democracies, and I think that's very fair, democracies depend on the fact that you can be forgotten in a way, right? You have the right to make sure that people don't know where you are. You have the right to just be ignored by the state and by everyone else. You can just do whatever you want with no one knowing that you're doing it. And that's an important, I think, an important element of liberal democracies, is that you can just do whatever you want when you want to, well, unless you're doing something illegal and against somebody else. But if you're not harming anyone, you can do whatever you want. And so do you feel that ultimately, if we continue this way, and given that it's a bit like taxes, once you get one tax on something, it's hard to go back, because then you have that extra money. In that case, you have that extra power, even if it is for good reasons. Do you think that liberal democracies will persist as they are with these new technologies? Is it possible to ensure using our current checks and balances, are they strong enough to contain the risks of those very, very new technologies?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And it's, I think the jury remains out on this. So these technologies are extremely powerful in a host of ways, including in the ability of machine learning based artificial intelligence to make accurate predictions about people's behavior in the future, which is just something sort of unprecedented in the history of technology. these computers apply statistical methods. You know, statistics, the theory of statistics and probability has been around for a while, but it's always been limited by the, you know, computing power of the human brain. But now that we have machines that in a very narrow sense are intelligent or becoming intelligent, not in the way that we are intelligent, but in a computational sense, and becoming much more powerful at performing sophisticated computations well beyond our abilities as humans. This enables machines to predict human behavior and potentially to be used to modify human behavior in subtle ways. This has already been employed in the West by commercial firms and in China and other authoritarian states for more political purposes. But the question is, so I mean, here we have a technology that enables political leaders to gain a degree of insight, prediction, and control over populations that was unheard of in human history. How plausible is it that once they get that power, they will voluntarily renounce it in the future? I don't know. I think certainly in the West, we are in a much better position to contest illegitimate or morally dubious uses of AI because of exactly the reason that you point to. Our systems of checks and balances, or even more fundamentally, I think, the fact of divided power, the fact that we in the West have multiple centers of authority and power, including civil society. So we have independent news organizations, independent universities and think tanks and so forth that can look into these moral and political questions raised by new technologies and help to inform public debate around them. I'll give you one example in the Western case. So in so-called, what's come to be called surveillance capitalism, a new mode of doing business in economically advanced high-tech countries, firms will collect enormous amounts of information about their customers, the websites that they go to, their interests, their shopping habits, their marriage, you know, status, their marriage, their gender, sexuality, age, politics, all sorts of stuff. I mean, basically anything that could be inferred from a data trail of your behavior online or with your phone or in shopping or in stores can be grouped in a file by what's called a data broker company, data brokerage, and then resold to commercial entities to target you for particular kinds of advertising or particular marketing. So in the United States, there was an infamous case, I like to use this example because it gets people's attention, of a family, a small family with a teenage daughter who started to receive pregnancy-related advertisements from the American supermarket chain Target. And, you know, cribs, baby strollers, baby milk, that sort of thing. And the father of the teenage girl became upset about this because he thought that Target was normalizing teen pregnancy. And he went to Target to complain about this and later discovered that Target had actually used artificial intelligence, data science, big data science to discover that, well, not his daughter in particular, but any young woman who purchases a certain collection of products products that have nothing to do with pregnancy, like creams and shampoos and other things, are statistically more likely to be in the early phases of pregnancy. So Target then, you know, the machine discovered this and started sending out advertisements to this family. So they knew about his, I mean, they knew in quotes, you know, the machine inferred that his daughter was pregnant before this poor chap himself knew that his daughter was pregnant. Now, most people are creeped out by this story, right? They hear this story and they think, wow, this seems like it's kind of invasive and a bit too far. Unfortunately, this practice continues to this day, and it's not just Target, it's many large retailers, including retailers in Europe. They run pregnancy prediction algorithms on their female customers. However, it got out in the press and it started a debate, and professors or whoever are questioning about whether they think there should be limits, age limits, for instance, or consent agreements for this kind of use of data. So this shows that in the West, we do have a strength, which is our openness to debate. We have multiple centers of power, including civil society, and we can debate these questions. And the public can voice outrage about certain uses of data. And the possibility of reform is much greater than in a centralized or autocratic system where the state owns people's data. And there is really no avenue to challenge the way that data is collected and used.
That actually makes us wonder, I think, on the links between those big firms that collect the data and states. Because I think you're completely right that when you're in a Western, in a well-established democracy, you feel safer in a way, because you feel that the state will not abuse the information it has. But it is also true, it's becoming clearer that some firms in Western well-established democracies are yielding to some extent to states, and particularly to autocratic or non-democratic types of states. So do you think that that we're increasingly we feel comfortable and sort of safe in our countries in a way, but do you think that we're being too we're not being savvy enough, and we do not understand that the risks that within our own countries there's this increasing risk that we are being manipulated, not only for commercial purposes but even for electoral and political purposes. So perhaps it's difficult to say that we're really that safe in Europe or West, well, Europe, US, etc., and other, well, not only in the West, but established democracies.
Indeed, yeah, that's a good point. And I think this is something that has not gained the public attention that it deserves, at least in Portugal and in particular, and in Western Europe more generally. So for decades in the 20th century, there was an assumption that with increasing globalization and the expansion of the free market, it would sort of naturally go, this process of economic liberalization would naturally go hand in hand with political liberalization. Most of the political elites in the West accepted this view, both the sort of center-right and center-left in the West accepted this view for decades. And I think it's becoming clear now that that's too simple, too simplistic, that there are alternative forms of capitalism, if you want to call it, that are consistent with fundamentally non-democratic and illiberal forms of political power. And as Western firms want to have access to markets in non-democratic states, they are increasingly finding themselves involved unwittingly or unwittingly in forms of censorship of speech and behavior in the West. So I'll give you just a couple examples of this. One from today's paper that you meant that we were discussing before, the platform Zoom, which is used by universities around the world, is censored the Zoom streaming accounts of some pro-democracy, Chinese pro-democracy activists in the United States. So these were people who fled China after the Tiananmen protests and who live in the United States. And Zoom was contacted by the Chinese government, who informed them that there was going to be a vigil taking place on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and that this violated local laws in China because there were people in China that were going to be present at these events. And Zoom has a lot of its users and a lot of its employees, in fact, are in mainland China. And so they abided by the Chinese request to cancel, well, to censor the accounts, to deactivate them so that the event could not proceed. That's just one example. I mean, there's been, that's the most recent one that I know of, but there have been more, in some ways, more dramatic examples. For instance, the case of the National Basketball Association in the United States, right, which is an extremely lucrative global brand, very, very powerful, you know, brand around the world. And there are more NBA fans in China than there are citizens in the United States, right? Than the population of the entire United States ever since Yao Ming started playing basketball. And so it's gained popularity. The NBA has been bringing players to China that for on sort of friendly games and photo ops, and the hope has been to expand partnership and open greater avenues into the market in China, which is all good, free market, you know, non-zero sum, positive sum capitalism, right? Unfortunately, and that's the way, you know, things were working out for quite a while. But lately, the politics has become more contentious between the United States and China. And there are a owner of the Houston Rockets, a basketball team in the United States that's particularly popular in Japan, in China, in Asia generally. And the owner of this team tweeted, simply retweeted a post about Hong Kong as the revolution of our times, or whatever the phrase is, retweeted it on his personal account, not his team official account, but in his own personal account, which then provoked a lot of outrage in China, which was saw this as sort of meddling in internal politics. It angered not only the government, but, you know, the more nationalist end of this citizenry, lots of angry comments and posts and videos on social media. And the NBA was threatened by China that look, if you want to continue to pursue the possibility of you know, a season in China and games in China, and to continue to have market access, valuable, lucrative market access, you need to condemn this. You need to fire the guy. You need to get rid of this guy. This is not acceptable. Now, the NBA couldn't fire the guy for sort of domestic political purposes in the United States, but they did the next closest thing, which was effectively to denounce what the guy said. Several big name players, including LeBron James, you know, one of the world's most famous players, were sort of wheeled out onto the stage to say that this guy didn't know what he was talking about and he was being condescending or racist or whatever. And so the guy is still the owner of the Houston Rockets, but he was chastised by the NBA, and who sort of with one mouth for the West said, yeah, free speech, he's allowed to do this, but and then with the other side of the mouth for China said, this, we're very sorry, we apologize greatly for all the offense caused and so forth. So this is an interesting phenomenon that is in some ways unprecedented, which is the use of certain aspects of our institutions and organizations and interests in the West, including our free market economic institutions, for purposes that run counter to other aspects of our political culture, our protection of free speech, our thought that people's personal accounts, you know, in America or Portugal or whatever, you can have whatever position on Hong Kong you want. You can be in defense of the Chinese, mainland Chinese CCP position, or in defense of the protesters or whatever. It's sort of, we're free, open societies. You can take whatever positions you want and be able to, you know, should be able to debate them publicly and argue with whoever you want about it. However, that kind of freedom, I think, is under increasing strain as a result of the sort of the economic interdependence of our societies and our companies, and the ability of kind of surveillance and if 30 years ago they probably would have never known that the owner of the Houston Rockets had any views about Hong Kong. Whereas nowadays, given that we can share and tweet these things online and we can use new technologies to surveil people's speech about Hong Kong online, this enables forms of surveillance and censorship that are very new.
Well, that's really interesting. And thank you so much, William, for such an interesting talk. I'm sure we'll have